Welcome to the 1984 Book Club Conspiracy Classics. And buckle up, because part one of Orwell's 1984 hits eerily close to home. From telescreens and thought crimes to children ratting out their parents, this dystopian fiction is more than just a nightmare fantasy. It's a prediction of the world we may already be living in. We're going to decode how newspeak shaped cancel culture, how history is still being rewritten, and why Orwell's "proles and animals are free" may be the most terrifying line of all. Join me for the ultimate Red Pill Book Club. That's right, I've been teasing this 1984 Book Club for weeks now, and we're going to run through it. This is going to be a three-part series. I'm doing a little out of order of my typical, right? Normally I'm like, hey, let's nerd out on who the author is and what his background is. We're actually going to do that in part three. All right. Part one and two is just getting through the book. All right. Then in part three, we're going to unpack George Orwell's life and talk about how all these themes exist in today's modern culture. It's going to be a wild ride. While I'm talking, I need you to go subscribe to the show, however you're consuming it right now. And make sure you come back for part two and three, because I put a lot of effort into this. This is going to be quite the series, and it's going to be the most important one. You know, we did a previous conspiracy classic series with James Shelby Downard and King Kill 33, which was very prolific. That was on the supporter feeds only. This one's the second iteration of the conspiracy classics, and this is going to go out on all the feeds, all right? 1984 is important because it's a book that every conspiracy theorist cites, because it warns us of what happens when extreme ideologies take root in our governments and it turns into an Orwellian nightmare, hence the term, right? One of the themes I discovered was that Orwell wasn't a boogeyman. I always thought he was, you know. He was trying to warn us about authoritarianism, and he was also a leftist. He was, you know, Antifa, right? Anti-fascism. And he was warning us about worshiping the government, which yet again takes me down this path of wondering about who's the bad guys here. We're going to talk about all this in the conclusion of part three. But for now, I think it's important we get into the book right off the bat. No shorts, no losses. We're getting right into it. And if you don't know what the book is, it's a dystopian view of the future where a totalitarian government uses surveillance and compliance in conjunction with a thought police to suppress rebellion so that they can have a total system of control, all right? And this book was published June 8th, 1949, right after World War II, okay? So, part one and two, we're just going to go through the book. Part one, we're going to be looking at, because there's three parts in the book. I know this gets confusing. In the book, there's three parts. In part one of my show, we're going to go through part one. And then in the second episode of my show, we're going to finish the book, parts two and three, all right? And then, like I said, part three, or episode three of my show, we're going to get into George Orwell and talk about who he was and what's up with him. You know, West Side. Okay? All right. Now, the book starts out. Oh, also, I always give you the, hey, do I recommend you read this before you listen? No, not at all. I actually read the book, and I know this is probably heresy, but I thought it was kind of boring, to be honest. You want my brutal, honest opinion? I think it's boring. I think I would rather listen to me talk about the book for 3 hours than read the book. But you do what you want, okay? Part one, chapter one. They introduce us to the world of 1984. And our main protagonist of the story, which is Winston Smith, okay? And he lives in Britain, which is now called Oceania, because they rearrange all the, you know, it's like a future world. So all the countries and borders are different. There's only a handful of countries now. They're consolidating towards the one world order, okay? Specifically, he lives in Airstrip 1, which used to be called London, okay? And we're introduced to the party, a.k.a. Big Brother, up in this piece, running it, okay? And Winston, he works for the government. He works for the Ministry of Truth. But he's not feeling it. He's really not feeling it. He's real suspicious about everything going on. And then he goes home, and he's walking around town. Everything stinks. It smells like cabbage. Everyone drinks Victory Gin, which, to be honest, that's kind of how I picture Britain anyway. My ignorant American ass, I've never been there. I picture like beans and toast and cabbage and stuff. But shots fired at Britain. Just kidding. I've never been there. It's probably a beautiful country. It's probably way more beautiful than where I live, okay? And then also, like, the V for victory is what this reminds me of, the victory gin. Because Winston Churchill during World War II did the V sign, right? The V for victory sign. And this is based off of Aleister Crowley's sign of Typhon, the sign of Nodens. It was supposed to counter the occult forces that the Nazis were employing, because this, as the story goes, Crowley was a spy, a British spy, and they asked him, "Hey, what do we do? These Nazis are crazy. They're doing all this occult stuff. They're using vril energy and making contact with entities." And he was like, "All right, you make contact with some other entities to combat the, you know, solar forces they were using, and you call upon the Beast of the Abyss. You use the symbol of the peace sign. It's a V for Nodens." Now, Big Brother is putting up propaganda posters all over, and it always says, "Big Brother is watching you." It's the subtle form of coercion and intimidation. Furthermore, they've got screens everywhere, which kind of sounds like our world today, only these screens are a little more advanced. They're called telescreens, and it's a surveillance system. It's, you can't shut them off. They're always watching. They're always listening. It's a total surveillance state everywhere you go. And in Big Brother, there's three main propaganda slogans. You've got war is peace, freedom is slavery, and ignorance is strength. Right? And these are all sort of inversion tactics, obviously. We'll talk about more in the conclusion. And our man Winston works for the Ministry of Truth. And they used a different language called Newspeak in 1984. And in Newspeak, they abbreviate it to Mini True. Not that it really matters. It's just something in the book. And Newspeak is their official language. And they even have an appendix in the book and all this stuff. And there's four main components, four big ministries within the government. You've got the Ministry of Truth, Peace, Love, and Plenty. Plenty is the economy. All right. So you got Mini True, Mini Peace, you get it, right? And the Ministry of Love is like the hardest one to get into. And you find out there's no laws, but you can still get the death penalty for simple things, simple acts of rebellion, like having a diary, which Winston proceeds to do. He proceeds to have a journal. He's got a diary. He's a bad boy, all right? Winston's a bad boy. Don't get it twisted. And he starts by saying, all right, it's April 4th, 1984. But then he's like, I don't really know what day it is, because that's another theme. He's like, nobody really knows what day it is because there's so much propaganda, so much misinformation. None of it really matters. All that matters is what Big Brother wants. And Winston, he's going to work. He's going to Mini True, and they're preparing for what they call the 2 minutes of hate. And it's this scene where everyone gets together. And there's this man named O'Brien. He works for the party, the government, right? There's synonymous terms. You got government, Big Brother, and the party. It's kind of all the same thing. The ruling elites, the government, right? You get what I'm saying? And they're all in this giant room, and the screen flashes. And it's Emmanuel Goldstein, who is known as the enemy of the state. And everyone's supposed to hate this guy. No one knows where he is because he escaped. Some people believe he's still in Oceania. He's also, if you can't tell by the name, he's a member of the Blue and Whites. And this book was published after 1949, right? So that was obviously a big, big theme back then, especially. And this Goldstein guy, he wrote the book, which inspires people to join this rebellion. But the thought police from the party, from Big Brother, they keep finding these people trying to leave and join the rebellion. And they publicly execute them so, you know, everyone could see they're not playing around. No shorts, no losses for the party. So anyway, they're in this big room, and there's the big giant telescreen, and they see Goldstein, the leader of the rebellion, on the screen. Everyone's screaming, and they're frothing all over, like, they're all mad, right? It's 2 minutes of hate, because the hate is a whole thing. They promote hatred, and it's contagious in the community. And Goldstein's going through all these actually pretty interesting ideas on how you can transfer the hate, like how he hates the party. That's the whole, that's Goldstein's whole thing, is like he hates the guy, the Big Brother, the party. And the people are supposed to put their hate energy on Goldstein, and he doesn't, you know, he's like, you know, you need to turn that on your oppressors. Don't mess with me, fool. What you talking about? So anyway, it's a thing they do. It's just, you know, it's more like ritualistic programming of having an enemy. Because, you know, that's like the main thing of every war criminal leader, is to come up with an enemy to get everybody to rally around and to hate the other. So there's a woman who works in the same building as Winston, and he fantasizes about slicing her throat while having sex with her, which is strange to me because that reminded me of what, what's the name of the woman in the Manson family? Susan Atkins. I think it was Susan Atkins who said she was going to do that to Tom Jones, the singer. And like everyone in Hollywood was bugging. They were like, oh, who are they going to kill next? Like that exact thing, like slicing his throat while they were having sex. But in the book, I'm going to read you from it. They talk about this hate transfer concept, okay? I'm going to read you from the book. Winston succeeded in transferring his hate from the face on the screen to the dark-haired girl behind him. Vivid, beautiful hallucinations flashed through his mind. He would flog her to death with a rubber truncheon. He would tie her naked to a stake and shoot her full of arrows like Saint Sebastian. He would ravish her and cut her throat at the moment of climax. Better than before, moreover, he realized why it was that he hated her. He hated her because she was young and pretty and sexless. Because he wanted to go to bed with her and would never do so. Because round her sweet, supple waist, which seemed to ask you to encircle it with your arm, there was only the odious scarlet sash, an aggressive symbol of chastity. And it made me think, is this kind of how our modern society works, how mainstream media works? We transfer our hate into symbols that they're guiding and showing to us. Stuff like, for example, we feel the middle class being squeezed, right? Like our income doesn't stretch as far as it used to. Everything's getting more expensive. Our pay rates aren't going up. Everyone's got to work three freaking jobs now. So the news will tell us that, well, like Fox News will be like, well, it's because you got all these illegals, you know, taking over and invading the country illegally. So the transfer of hate is to hate them, to take it out on them. They are the scapegoat. And they are the whole reason for this problem. But the real problem is because the corporations aren't paying enough. They're not paying a living wage. They want a slave labor class. And they want us to blame. They want us to transfer the hate onto other people. So Winston, he's in his journal. He's writing more like a fool. And he writes, down with Big Brother. Like, oh man, this guy is like, he's a bad boy for show. And these are thought crimes. You can't even think these things. And in a way, the book explains how writing them down or not writing it down doesn't really matter. All of it's illegal. You can't even think down with Big Brother, much less write it. And they can snatch you up, because it's a police state, of course, and make you disappear. They call it vaporizing. It gets rid of your whole existence, your whole history. There's no record of you anywhere now. You're gone forever. Which is pretty insidious. You can't even keep the memories. Like, dang, man. But it's all a battle for the mind, right? That's chapter one. Now we're in chapter two. And we meet Winston's neighbors. They're the Parsons. Maybe, obviously, I'm thinking about Jack Parsons. That's kind of where the similarities end for that. And we hear about how the children are in this dystopia nightmare future. And they're worse than ever. All right? I'm going to read you from the book again. With those children, he thought, that wretched woman must lead a life of terror. Another year, 2 years, and they would be watching her night and day for symptoms of unorthodoxy. Nearly all children nowadays were horrible. What was worst of all was that by means of such organizations as the spies, they were systematically turned into ungovernable little savages. And yet this produced in them no tendency whatever to rebel against the disciple of the party. On the contrary, they adored the party and everything connected with it. The songs, the processions, the banners, the flags, the hiking, the drilling with dummy rifles, the yelling of slogans, the worship of Big Brother. It was all a sort of glorious game to them. All their ferocity was turned outwards against the enemies of the state, against foreigners, traitors, saboteurs, thought criminals. It was almost normal for people over 30 to be frightened of their own children. And with good reason, for hardly a week passed in which the Times did not carry a paragraph describing how some eavesdropping little sneak child hero, that was the phrase generally used, had overheard some compromising remark and denounced its parents to the thought police. So, and they continue talking about the public executions, you know, to keep the snitches from keep the rebellion down. We learn more about the kids ratting out the parents. They talk about the diary some more, and you know, the Winston questions whether or not he should even write this thing. No one's ever going to see it, and history gets deleted. You know, they're in total control of the history and the story of what happens through the ministry of quote unquote truth. All right. Then we got chapter 3. Winston, he's got dreams of his mother and father. They've been dead since the 50s. They died in purges. And he has a dream of being with the same girl, the girl with the dark hair that he was talking about slicing her throat. And they're in a pasture. And he wakes up, and now they have to do mass PT, physical therapy, right? Very much run like the military. We also hear about how the party will constantly adjust history and facts, quote-unquote facts, in order to fit their goals. And they talk about how all enemies are absolute enemies. Like, there's no good to be found within any kind of enemy. They're absolute garbage. We also get the classic iconic line, "Who controls the past now controls the future." Like Rage Against the Machine said, you know. I'm going to read you from the book. Beyond the late 50s, everything faded. When there were no external records that you could refer to, even the outline of your own life lost its sharpness. You remembered huge events which had quite probably not happened. You remembered the detail of incidents without being able to recapture their atmosphere. And there were long blank periods to which you could assign nothing. Everything had been different then. Even the names of countries and their shapes on the map had been different. Airstrip 1, for instance, had not been so called in those days. It had been called England or Britain, though London, he felt fairly certain, had always been called London. So again, you've got this idea about like what's real, what's history. It doesn't matter. It's what the party wants it to be. And towards the end of the chapter, he talks about how the party lies about everything, with things such as like how they invented the airplane, even though Winston knows he saw the airplanes as a child. So he knows that they're lying. He's lived long enough that he's seen it. But it doesn't matter. The party is all about lying, and you stick to the lie, which I think is something that Goebbels said, right? The propaganda minister from the Nazi party, didn't he say, if you're going to lie big and stick to it? Paraphrasing. It's something like that, okay? I'm going to vamp for a second. I need a drink. Okay. Chapter 4, moving on. You know, we're going to plow through this because there's a lot to get through. But it's important because this is the book everyone references. We need to understand what's in it. Chapter 4. Winston has a dreaded day job at Mini True, right? And his job is to rewrite history, which is another reason he's so suspicious about the party. He's like, dude, these guys are liars. And his whole job is to rewrite the news and the arts to support whatever the state wants to say happened. Right? They would even rewrite articles to show that the state predicted the future after the fact and be like, oh, yeah, we predicted this would happen. And they never predicted it. they give an example about boots and the economy, and they're referring to the Ministry of Plenty over, you know, with the economy. He's going to fix the economy. And how all these predictions are proven correct and all truth in history and the dates of what really happened become shadowed. It's kind of like vapor, the vaporizing of a person. It's gone, right? Now, he doesn't approve of any of this. Winston doesn't, because he's more of a truth warrior. But nonetheless, it's the dreaded day job. And, you know, ironically, he loves to work. So he's like, all right, bet, we'll do it. I'm going to read you from the book. And the records department, after all, was itself only a single branch of the Ministry of Truth, whose primary job was not to reconstruct the past, but to supply the citizens of Oceania with newspapers, films, textbooks, telescreen programs, plays, novels, with every conceivable kind of information, instruction, or entertainment. From a statue to a slogan, from a lyric poem to a biological treatise, and from a child's spelling book to a Newspeak dictionary. And the ministry had not only to supply the multifarious needs of the party, but also to repeat the whole operation at a lower level for the benefit of the proletariat. There was a whole chain of separate departments dealing with proletariat literature. Sorry, I've got dashes on my little teleprompter. It's messing me all up. I'm still new, okay? Still new to this teleprompting business. Music, drama, and entertainment generally. Oh, and while I'm talking about teleprompter, go subscribe to my YouTube channel, At Occult Symbolism, if you haven't. It's my third channel. I'm rebuilding. I'm trying to be professional. I got a nice little teleprompter system set up. It's real great. I can just stare right into your eyes instead of looking down at my screen for my notes, okay? All right. Back to the book. Here we're produced rubbishy newspapers containing almost nothing except sport, crime, and astrology, sensational 5-cent novelettes, films oozing with sex, and sentimental songs which were composed entirely by mechanical means on a special kind of kaleidoscope known as a versificator. There was even a whole subsection, pornosec, it was called in Newspeak, engaged in producing the lowest kind of pornography, which was sent out in sealed packets and which no party member, other than those who worked on it, was permitted to look at. So you can hear about how entertainment basically all entertainment is used for programming with instruction to the masses. Even sports ball, right? Even the sports ball is part of the propaganda and manipulation of all the inhabitants to love the party, to love Big Brother, love their subjugation, to be distracted. Very much taken from the ideas of Rome, you know, bread and circus and whatnot. Now we're already in chapter 5. Let's go. Chapter 5, Winston is having lunch at the canteen cafeteria, and he talks to Simi, I guess, like Simon, like Sime, who works, this is a guy who works on the dictionary, the Newspeak dictionary, and his whole job is to reduce the number of words in the total vocabulary of the society. And this is what he says about it. It's a beautiful thing, the destruction of words. Of course, the great wastage is in the verbs and adjectives, but there are hundreds of nouns that can be got rid of as well. It isn't only the synonyms, there are also the antonyms. After all, what justification is there for a word which is simply the opposite of some other word? A word contains its opposite in itself. Take good, for instance. If you have a word like good, what need is there for a word like bad? Ungood will do just as well, better, because it's an exact opposite, which the other is not. Or again, if you want a stronger version of good, what sense is there in having a whole string of vague, useless words like excellent and splendid and all the rest of them? Plus good covers the meaning, or double plus good if you want something stronger still. Of course, we use those forms already. But in the final version of Newspeak, there'll be nothing else. In the end of the whole notion, and goodness and badness will be covered by only 6 words. In reality, only 1 word. Don't you see the beauty of that, Winston? It was BB's idea originally, of course, he added as an afterthought. So the reduction of words is important, and it's this kind of, like, I feel like 1984 is a good part two to the Idiocracy film analysis we did a few years ago. And you can kind of see how that works with social media and Twitter and so on. Like, you reduce the words themselves down to, you know, abbreviations and so on. I don't know if that's the same effect. But we're actually going to talk about this idea of reducing the words. There's actually an idea behind this that's, you know, illuminate confirm. I'm going to read you a little bit more about this because it's actually really interesting. And actually, when the way he talks, I'm like, I don't know, that kind of makes sense. I'd rather, because, yeah, what's the difference between bad and horrible? But that's like the engineer mind. That's like the logic mind, which is what all of these tech bros want you to think like. They don't want you to see the beauty and the art in different words and terms and prose and so on. It's about stripping things down to their utility. It's about function only, right? Function only, which is what you see with the today's cars. You know, almost every vehicle that sells now is some weird like mini SUV. It's like the ultimate utility vehicle, and it's true. Like, that's very useful. You don't really want to, you know, you don't want a pickup truck. You don't want a car. You want something kind of in between, and there you go. That's what everything is sort of boiled down to now, and that's what everybody drives. Okay, I'm going to get back to the book. Don't you see that the whole aim of Newspeak is to narrow the range of thought? Huh? In the end, we shall make thought crime literally impossible because there will be no words in which to express it. Every concept that can ever be needed will be expressed by exactly one word, with its meaning rigidly defined and all its subsidiary meanings rubbed out and forgotten. Already in the 11th edition, we're not far from that point. But the process still will be continuing long after you and I are dead. Every year, fewer and fewer words, and the range of consciousness always a little smaller. Even now, of course, there's no reason or excuse for committing thought crime. It's merely a question of self-discipline, reality control. But in the end, there won't be any need even for that. The revolution will be complete when the language is perfect. Newspeak is Ingsoc, and Ingsoc is Newspeak, he added with a sort of mystical satisfaction. Has it ever occurred to you, Winston, that by the year, at least the very latest, not a single human being will be alive who could understand such a conversation as we are having right now? Except, began Winston doubtfully, and he stopped. It had been on the tip of his tongue to say, except the proles, but he checked himself, not feeling fully certain that this remark was not in some way unorthodox. Simi, however, had divined what he was about to say. The proles are not human beings, he said carelessly. Right? There's that, like, sort of degradation. By earlier, probably, all real knowledge of old speak will have disappeared. The whole literature of the past will have been destroyed. Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton, Byron, they'll exist only in Newspeak versions, not merely changed into something different, but actually changed into something contradictory of what they used to be. Even the literature of the party will change. Even the slogans will change. How could you have a slogan like freedom is slavery when the concept of freedom has been abolished? The whole climate of thought will be different. In fact, there will be no thought as we understand it now. Orthodoxy means not thinking, not needing to think. Orthodoxy is unconsciousness. And that's where we get to the point of the whole idea of reducing the words and using the Newspeak. The Newspeak is about reducing the range of consciousness, which is exactly what he says. That's what it's about. They want to dumb us down to restrict our range of consciousness, meaning we're not going to think outside the box. We're not going to question what they're doing. We're just going to go along with the program. We're going to do what we're told. We're not going to think like, hey, you know, what if we didn't do that? We're just going to, okay, sounds good. Give me sports ball. Give me gin. You know, that's what they want. And in this chapter, they rounded out by talking about how everything's rationed and how everyone's happy, you know, which is very Great Reset. You'll own nothing and be happy. They're going to ration out things like chocolate and housing. you know? And they, and if you bitch about it, if you talk about it in the story, if you point out, like, because they lower the rations of chocolate and someone points it out and vaporize, boom, see you never, sucker. You're supposed to say, thank you, may I have another? All right. Chapter six. Now, chapter six is all about sex. Six is sex. And the party controls sex, like they control everything. And again, it's sort of like the idea of restricting and reducing consciousness. The idea is to ultimately restrict and suppress the human spirit. It's too liberating to have too much sex, right? And it's more insidious than that. I'm going to read to you from the book again. Winston thinks your worst enemy was your own nervous system. Winston was married to Catherine, but he doesn't even know if she's alive or not. Only the proles use perfumes. Party women would never. Winston would frequent the prostitutes, which was forbidden. See, he's a bad boy. You could have sex with lower class, which is the proles, the proletariats, right? You could have sex with them, but it was viewed as disgust, all right? To be caught with a prostitute might mean 5 years in a forced labor camp, not more, if you had committed no other offense. And it was easy enough, provided that you could avoid being caught in the act. The poorer quarters swarmed with women who were ready to sell themselves. Some could even be purchased for a bottle of gin, which the proles were not supposed to drink. Tacitly, the party was even inclined to encourage prostitution as an outlet for instincts which could not be altogether suppressed. Mere debauchery did not matter very much, so long as it was furtive and joyless and only involved the women of a submerged and despised class. The unforgivable crime was promiscuity between party members. But though this was one of the crimes that the accused in the great purges invariably confessed to, oh boy, my notes cut off. Okay. All right, so continuing on. The aim of the party was not merely to prevent men and women from forming loyalties which it might not be able to control. Its real undeclared purpose was to remove all pleasure from the sexual act. Not love so much as eroticism was the enemy, inside marriages as well as outside it. All marriages between party members had to be approved by a committee appointed for the purpose, and though the principle was never clearly stated, permission was always refused if the couple concerned gave the impression of being physically attracted to one another. The only recognized purpose of marriage was to beget children for the service of the party. And side note, you know, you hear Elon Musk and all these people now talking about how we need to have all these children, and you know, I don't know if that's the exact same reason. Like, Elon Musk thinks we're going to have population collapse. So he's doing his part by having 20 kids. And it's interesting that in the book they were talking about they wanted to procreate to have new slaves for the party. Sexual intercourse was to be looked on as a slightly disgusting minor operation, like having an enema. This, again, was never put into plain words, but in an indirect way, it was rubbed into every party member from childhood onwards. There were even organizations such as the Junior Anti-Sex League, which advocated complete celibacy for both sexes. All children were to be begotten by artificial insemination, art-sem, it was called in Newspeak, and brought up in public institutions. This, Winston was aware, was not meant altogether seriously, but some, how it fitted it with the general ideology of the party. The party was trying to kill the sex instinct, or if it could not be killed, then to distort it and dirty it. He did not know why this was so, but it seemed natural that it should be so. And as far as the women were concerned, the party's efforts were largely successful. Now, the whole idea here is that they wanted to kill the sex instinct. And as a human being, there's a handful of drives, and sex is one of them. So, and it's obviously one of the most powerful forces in our culture. You know, you got presidents and stuff throwing it all away for a hummer for the summer, you know, So there's obviously a lot of power in that. And I think that that scares them and they want to sort of mitigate it. And they do that. And you could argue that this is one of the roles of the church and religion is to suppress the power of sex and to label it as dirty. Right. And even if it has a, positive aspect to it, there's a certain amount of shame baked into the, and I don't want to turn this into a religion show, but there's a certain amount of shame baked into it. And you can even argue that maybe that's because of the ideas of like sex magic being used by the occult, tapping into energies and so on. All right, let's move on. We're going to chapter 7 and we're going to talk about how the only hope for humanity for this nightmarish future is to rely on the proletariats, the poors, right? They call them the proles, and they describe it as such. I'm going to read you some more. If there was hope, it must lie in the proles, because only there, in those swarming, disregarded masses, percent of the population of Oceania, could the force to destroy the party ever be generated. The party could not be overthrown from within. Its enemies, if it had any enemies, had no way of coming together or even of identifying one another. Even if the legendary brotherhood existed, as just possibly it might, it was inconceivable that its members could ever assemble in larger numbers than twos and threes. Rebellion meant a look in the eyes, an inflection of the voice, at the most an occasional whispered word. But the proles, if only they could somehow become conscious of their own strength, would have no need to conspire. They needed only to rise up and shake themselves like a horse shaking off flies. If they chose, they could blow the party to pieces tomorrow morning. Surely sooner or later it must occur to them to do it. And yet, right, and this is very much the idea of like voting, like there's actually power in voting, and that's one of the things I always push back on. Some of the apathetic ideas that come from the conspiracy movement of, it's all rigged. And I get that. I'm not saying that certain bloodlines and candidates aren't chosen on some level. But you could try to vote in your local politicians, right? If you wanted to believe that the presidential candidates are all, skull and bones chosen selected candidates. So in the book, what they're doing is they're describing the proles, the proletariats, being the poor class that the Brotherhood saved from the capitalists, because that's the big propaganda that the Brotherhood, the party, tells the poors, the proles, like, hey, we saved you. The capitalists were going to eat you up alive, and then we came along and gave you a better future. So they did this by allowing them to do certain things. The proles were allowed to gamble as long as they kept on slaving because they worked in the coal mines, right? Weren't we recently talking about reopening coal mines? Wasn't that a whole big thing about a year ago? Remember? They worked coal mines as young as 6. Winston also believes they're the only ones that can actually spark the revolution. And he had destroyed, working in the Ministry of Truth, past confessions of different traitors. So he also believed in this kind of thing. And the proles, they were instilled and filled with patriotism, but no real knowledge, right? And they used the term, they said the proles and the animals were the only ones free. They thought they were free and they weren't. Which is how a lot of people view America, right? We always pound our chest about freedom, and you could argue that we're not as free as we say we are. I'm going to read you from the book for more understanding. The party claimed, of course, to have liberated the proles from bondage. Before the revolution, they had been hideously oppressed by the capitalists. They had been starved and flogged. Women had been forced to work in the coal mines. Women still did work in the coal mines, as a matter of fact. Children had been sold into the factories at the age of 6. But simultaneously, true to the principles of doublethink, the party taught that the proles were natural inferiors who must be kept in subjugation like animals by the application of a few simple rules. In reality, very little was known about the proles. It was not necessary to know much. So long as they continued to work and breed, their other activities were without importance. left to themselves, like cattle turned loose upon the plains of Argentina, they had reverted to a style of life that appeared to be natural to them, a sort of ancestral pattern. They were born, they grew up in the gutters, they went to work at 12, they passed through a brief blossoming period of beauty and sexual desire, they married at 20, they were middle-aged at 30, they died for the most part at 60. Heavy physical work, the care of home and children, petty quarrels with neighbors, films, football, beer, and above all, gambling, filled up the horizon of their minds. To keep them in control was not difficult. A few agents of the Thought Police moved always among them, spreading false rumors and marking down and eliminating the few individuals who were judged capable of becoming dangerous. But no attempt was made to indoctrinate them with the ideology of the party. It was not desirable that the proles should have strong political feelings. All that was required of them was a primitive patriotism, which could be appealed to whenever it was necessary to make them accept longer working hours or shorter rations. And even when they became discontented, as they sometimes did, their discontent led nowhere, because being without general ideas, they could only focus in on petty, specific grievances. The larger evils invariably escaped their notice. The great majority of proles did not even have telescreens in their homes. Even the civil police interfered with them very little. There was a vast amount of criminality in London, a whole world within a world of thieves, bandits, prostitutes, drug peddlers, and racketeers of every description. But since it all happened among the proles themselves, it was of no importance. In all questions of morals, they were allowed to follow their ancestral code. The sexual puritanism of the party was not imposed upon them. Promiscuity went unpunished. Divorce was permitted. For that matter, even religious worship would have been permitted if the proles had shown any signs of needing or wanting it. They were beneath suspicion. As the party slogan put it, proles and animals are free. Now, pretty interesting stuff here, and this reminds me of the whole idea of keeping people uneducated. Because again, there is this sort of push that we crap on the idea of going to college. And I get it because it's expensive, right? Like, I don't recommend people go to college if they don't plan on making more money with that degree. But to say that people shouldn't do it or shouldn't keep learning is foolish, right? You can learn on your own. You don't need college to do it. But if you want to use the, what did Trump say? He said, I love the uneducated. And that's the truth, right? Just like 1984, that's exactly what they want. They want that. And when they do that, they're actually allowed to live with more freedoms than some of the more higher class folks. And they talk about like football and beer and all these distractions. Again, you know, same theme. But the state, they tell the proles propaganda about their past, about how awful their lives used to be and how everything is so much better now, and they have no proof for any of this. They just tell them. And they're so stupid, they're like, yes, thank you so much. It says in the book, day and night the telescreens bruised your ears with statistics, proving that people today had more food, more clothes, better houses, better recreations, that they lived longer, worked shorter hours, were bigger, healthier, stronger, happier, more intelligent, better educated than the people of 50 years ago. Not a word of it could ever be proved or disproved. And this is where we get into dicey territory with this idea of fake news and subjective facts. It becomes kind of scary, right? To see who's the proprietor of truth, basically. And in this chapter, Winston finds proof of something happening in history that the state covered up, and the state was like, look, if this gets out, it'll be really damning, okay? And then they also talk about how there's this concept you'll hear about 2+2 in the book. And 2+2 is a test of freedom, all right? I'm going to read you this chapter. We're almost done. Hang in there. The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command. His heart sank as he thought of the enormous power arrayed against him, the ease with which any party intellectual would overthrow him in debate, the subtle arguments which he would not be able to understand, much less answer. And yet, he was in the right. They were wrong, and he was right. The obvious, the silly, and the true had got to be defended. Truisms are true. Hold on to that. The solid world exists. Its laws do not change. Stones are hard. Water is wet. Objects, unsupported, fall towards the earth's center. That's all, like, science talk, right? Because there's a lot of, like, pushback against science, which I'm not saying that's not justified in some levels, but... With the feeling that he was speaking to O'Brien and also that he was setting forth an important axiom, he wrote, "Freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. If that is granted, all else follows." And we're going to come back to that later on. That becomes more important towards the end of the book. But it's a test for freedom. All right, chapter 8, and then I think we are done. Yeah, we're done with part 1 of the book. See how much quicker that was? You don't want to read the book. You want to listen to me. chapter 8 starts out, Winston's talking to a guy that's old enough to remember pre-party days, pre-government, you know, pre-this 1984 world. Because now, Winston's like, bro, I think we're being brainwashed. And there's this concept relayed about individuality being suppressed in this world. They call it own self. And I'm going to read you from the book here one more. Yeah, one last. No, I got two passages and then we're done. It was assumed that when he was not working, eating, or sleeping, he would be taking part in some kind of communal recreation. To do anything that suggested a taste for solitude, even to go for a walk by yourself, was always slightly dangerous. There was a word for it in Newspeak, own life, it was called, meaning individualism and eccentricity. And this is kind of like saying you got to conform to the norms. You have to conform, and that's kind of what's going on in society today, right? An example would be like the LGBT thing, right? You got people who say they want to identify as this and that or whatever, and there's pushback against that, right? Right or wrong, I'm not making a statement on that. I'm just using that as an example that if you don't conform to the societal norms, you will be punished. Because in this 1984 world, everyone needs to be predictable and fall in line. I also argue this is why you see all this alpha red pill toxic, traditional masculinity stuff. They don't like the ideas of men going their own way. They want them to conform, which is actually the opposite of masculinity. Masculinity is about doing your own thing, not listening to what other people say. You know, if I want to paint my fingernails as a man, I'm going to do it. But if you listen to the alpha red pill bros, they're like, no, that's what sissies do. What happened to real men? You know, and what they're talking about is what happened is individuality becomes dangerous. And they want us to conform and to be very predictable and to have a place in the capitalist society. Same goes for women. They go through the same process too. Are you a real woman or a real man? And what that means is, are you a conformist male or woman? And like, I'm not saying there's shame in embracing traditional masculine elements. I embrace a lot of them. But I also don't shame other guys. Like if guys are like, man, I don't want to spend my time at the gym getting muscles and I want to like stay at home and play video games. I'm like, I don't know. Like, I don't look at that and say like, that's what I want to aspire to. But I'm like, do it, man. I don't care. Do you. Like, that's what a real man is. A real man doesn't listen to other people about what he should be doing on some level, right? On some level. You got to be able to handle criticism and try to show up for the better. Also, at the same time, okay? All right. Now, in the book, they talk about, in Chapter 8, they're rigging the lottery, of course, and the proles are very much into the lottery. They're like, I'm going to win. I'm going to be a millionaire someday. There's conspiracies that the lottery is rigged in America, too. Winston is talking to this old drunk guy, the dude that's been around forever, and trying to explain to him his beliefs about how the old society collapsed, and he talks about the end of capitalism. And Winston is like, he's struggling. He's like, were things better or worse before the party came along and sort of took over? And Winston tells this old man the party's version, and he says, that, listen to this. The history books say that life before the revolution was completely different from what it is now. There was the most terrible oppression, injustice, poverty worse than anything we can imagine. Here in London, the great mass of the people never had enough to eat from birth to death. Half of them hadn't even boots on their feet. The point is, these capitalists, they and a few lawyers and priests and so forth who lived on them, were the lords of the earth. Everything existed for their benefit. You, the ordinary people, the workers, were their slaves. They could do what they liked with you. They could ship you off to Canada like cattle. They could sleep with your daughters if they choose. Oh, my goodness. They could order you to be flogged with something called cat-o'-nine-tails. You had to take your cap off when you passed them. The problem is, even the old people are brainwashed. He compares them to ants and Let me sum up what we read here. So that passage, he's saying that this is the story that the party is putting out there, and he's trying to bump it up against this guy who's been around since before the party took over and be like, hey, is this true, right? And the way the party pitched it, they said, look, capitalism made things terrible. You were slaves back then, and this is a better system that we've provided you. Okay. But the old guy, he's like drunk and he can't really figure things out, and he's of no help, it turns out. So Winston's just like left on his own to be like, man, I know these fools are lying, but I just can't quite know. Right. And here's where, you know, we round out part one of the book, and Winston goes to an antique shop. He buys a coral paperweight, and he rents a room that's under the radar. It's got no telescreen. All right. So what's our little bad boy going to do? You're going to have to stay subscribed for the next episode. And we're going to, in the second episode that I do in this series, we're going to finish 1984, the book. The 1984 book club, conspiracy classics. We're going to break down the rest of Orwell's dystopian book. And we're going to start our comparison into the world we're living today. We're going to talk in part three about Orwell and who he was. And all these conversations are going to talk about mass surveillance, police state, corporate government collusion. You could argue this goes into dark enlightenment territory, even media-driven doublethink. And it could be that Big Brother is actually big tech, right? And they are trying to create this world in a way. So stay subscribed to the show on whatever platform you got that you're listening to it, because I'm going to hit you with part two where we're going to finish 1984. You know, go finish the book if you want and come back, and we're going to wrap up the book. And then in part three, we're going to go deep into who George L. Orwell was, because it's actually pretty fascinating. He lived a fascinating life, and he wasn't the guy I thought he was. All these years of hearing conspiracy people talk about 1984, I was confused until I actually sat down and read it and was like, oh, I think I get what's going on here. So, thank you for listening to the show. If you like the show, leave a review. Leave a 5-star review. We got to counter all those 1-star haters. How else are we going to do it? I can't do it without your help. This show cannot go on without your help. And you can help in many ways. One of the best ways, a 5-star review. Another great way, you could share it with a friend. You got a friend who quotes 1984? Thinks they know what's up? Have they ever read the book? Send this episode over to them. Say, what do you think now, smart guy? I don't know. Why am I being combative? Send it to a friend and say, hey, Isaac's doing a great book deep dive. Don't bother reading the book. It's pretty boring. And we're going to break it all down, and it's going to make sense. It's going to be great. Okay? And it's important because we need to keep our eyes open. We need to keep our peepers peeled to make sure we don't slide into this dystopian nightmare hell. Right? We don't want 1984 in 2026 or whatever, right? Thank you for your time. Till next time, stay positive.